This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, and Eric Luth, Global Emerging Market Economist in London. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning, Max.
And we're also joined by Ben Bennett, Head of Investment Strategy and Research in Hong Kong. Good evening, Ben.
Evening, Max.
Well, this is actually a special episode, as it was about a year ago to the day when we first huddled around a speakerphone, then still pre-social distancing in the London office, to talk about the impact of COVID-19 on markets. So with no further ado, Sonia, let's start where we always have done since then. What do investors need to know about the latest virus developments, the health of the global economy, and the state of markets today?
Yes, thank you, Max, and a very warm welcome to our listeners. Clearly, what a difference a year makes, and you know everything that has happened since. But as you know from our previous discussions, we're very much focused, obviously, on virus developments, which are now literally been overtaken by the debate around vaccine rollout and hence the efficiency of the vaccine. Because as we discussed previously, the successful rollout and application of vaccines obviously is the key ingredient in reopening economies. And as our listeners will know, our expectation is for a pretty strong cyclical recovery in the second half. And then what we should not forget, obviously, another key ingredient is stimulus efforts, something that we have debated at length, because obviously the unusual combination we have this time is that not only have central banks done again whatever it takes, but we have seen incredible support from governments this time. And the latest news obviously is coming from the US, where President Biden has put forward another very, very big stimulus program. And this is why when we then think about the economic setup, it's not surprisingly that there's a lot of expectation that there's pent-up demand from consumers, very much supported by these additional stimulus measures. And so far, it is playing out as we have expected. So we are seeing the US, UK very successfully rolling out the vaccines, although very interestingly, lots of headlines around the EU. But if you think about the full vaccination, i.e. the application of the first and the second jab, then it seems that the EU might actually finish at a very similar time than the UK. So clearly the two, US, UK, have had a head start, but maybe at the end of the day, we're talking more around timing nuances than a really kind of difference in the successful application of the vaccine. So with that cyclical recovery in mind, it's not surprising that, as we know, equity markets have reacted very positively already towards the end of 2020, very much geared towards this understanding that the application of stimulus plus the successful reopening of economies is a pretty potent mix for the economy. And hence, we've entered 2021 with this understanding of cyclical recovery, and that clearly equities is your preferred risk asset class against this backdrop. But then we had a bit of a conundrum because obviously the bond market initially didn't react as clearly. And I think this is why today our focus will be, you know, how has the bond market now caught up with events and what should investors make of this? And with that, I'm handing back over to you.
Thank you for that overview, Sonia. Yes, let's absolutely drill down into that theme of fixed income. So, Ben, in light of the recent volatility spurred by rising yields, what's the outlook for core government curves over the coming months? Could we soon be in taper tantrum territory if we aren't already? And what, if anything, can and should central banks do?
Well, this is actually a great timing because we had our monthly strategy meeting just on Tuesday. So, I mean, this is basically what we talked about as all the portfolio managers. And we have a base case for the next few months, which is still pretty positive, I think, for risky asset classes, where we don't think inflation is a massive risk, sustained inflation, until, let's say, this time next year. So without inflation constraining central banks, then we think the Fed, the Bank of England, the ECB are going to be supportive for markets, and that they will push back against any undue tightening of credit conditions. That, I think, is also positive as a base case for credit and equity markets over the next, at least the next 3 months. I think you're right, though, there are risks to that. And you mentioned one already on the taper tantrum. This is back in 2013, when we saw a big spike in real yields, went up by over 100 basis points in a very short period of time. And the dollar also rallied by about 5%. We've had about a third of a taper tantrum, funnily enough, in the moves that we've seen so far. And we have seen some volatility in credit and equity markets. But if that continues, like I said, I think the Fed would step in, the Bank of England would step in support, and therefore it could actually be a buying opportunity like it was back in 2013. The real more concerning downside risk would be a sustained inflation issue much quicker than what we're currently thinking, which is, like I said, earliest this time next year. And look, Sonia's spoken about $1.9 trillion. It's going to be $1,400 going to a lot of Americans very soon when Biden signs this. And they could be spending that money just as the economy opens. Potentially, we've just seen a big increase in oil. I mean, I'm painting a picture of what could go wrong. If we were to see that, we might even be talking about the first rate hike as early as, well, maybe the beginning of 2022. And then credit and equity markets are probably susceptible to a correction. I mean, they're pretty tight. Credit spreads are tight. Equity markets are quite expensive. But we think that that's a risk rather than a base case. So it is out there, but it's not our base case. Our base case is that things should still be okay for now.
Right. So reasons for confidence in the near term, but with inflation, the key theme to watch going forwards. More broadly, what do you think this recent episode tells us about the risks and opportunities stemming from investing in the low yield world you've just described?
Yeah, this is my pet topic. I love this topic because it's all about debt. And we've actually done a bit of work on this, and there's a series on the Elgin blog where bonds go bad and what to do about it. And that's something that a few of us have written about. And bonds have been for 40 years an amazing bull market. I mean, in the early 1980s, you had long-dated US Treasury yields at 15%. I mean, that's a decent yield. And then since that period of time, yields have been coming down, down, down. It's been, you just buy bonds, it's been a fantastic investment. You've got the yield. At the same time, and I think the two are correlated, we've seen debt go up and up and up for 40 years. And that's because it makes sense. As you see funding get cheaper and cheaper, then you take on more debt. That's been the household, the corporate, the government, everyone's been taking on more debt. And as debt has gone up, valuations for a lot of asset classes have also been boosted. For example, the housing market just loves more leverage. Everyone's got a bigger mortgage. I think corporate debt as well has been boosted by the fact that you can refinance at cheaper levels. And also equity markets. Multiples at equity markets have been going up over this period. I think partly because it's just been you've been able to get debt and leverage yourself as an equity investor. Now, all of that, I don't want to say comes to an absolute end, because a lot of people have been calling the bull market in bonds to an end incorrectly over the last number of years. But it's pretty hard now for central banks to cut yields much further than where they are today. And we've got to a level today where bond yields aren't particularly attractive. You can get a lot of negative yields around. They're just not attractive. And also in the next downturn, whereas previously central banks would slash interest rates and your bonds as your hedge within your portfolio protected, or your equity, equities would correct, but your bonds would do fantastic because they've slashed interest rates. That's not going to happen anymore because we've reached that lower bound. So what are bonds useful for? It's a pretty tricky question. And from a portfolio perspective, we're already thinking of replacing, what can we replace the yield of bonds and the hedging ability of bonds. From a yield perspective, you've got to look elsewhere. Chinese, I'm in Hong Kong now, so not far from China. Chinese government bond yields, 10-year government bond yields can give you still over 3%. Maybe that's an answer. And then on hedging, maybe you want to think about using currencies that are more correlated with risky asset classes, maybe even using inflation. As inflation today implied at above 2% in the US, if we have a recession, that presumably would collapse. So maybe you want to be underweight or short inflation in your portfolio to protect yourself for a market, a risk off, and that inflation will protect your outcome.
Lots of big questions there for long-term investors and asset allocators. Sonia, over the nearer term, at what point do you think rising yields become a material headwind to equity valuations? And we've already seen some rotation among sectors. Should yields continue to rise even gently, what might that mean for market leadership?
Yes, that is definitely a topic that has garnered a lot of attention over the short term, simply because obviously, as Ben said, the starting point in bond yields has been so low that obviously the speed with which we've seen a correction in the bond market always creates the uncertainty, you know, what does it mean for equities? But we have to distinguish, point one, what do rising bond yields mean for equities in general? And what is the rotation we should expect? Because normally when bond yield rise, it's understanding what is the reason for the rise in bond yields. And clearly, if it is the economic backdrop, as we have started this call, i.e. the expectation for a pretty decent cyclical recovery, then obviously the repricing of the bond market is in line with improving fundamentals. And improving fundamentals are good for earnings growth, and as such should be supportive to the equities market. And so speed and some potential for dislocation, equities never like. So we had to expect that because of the potential disruption, there is some volatility. But if you look actually at the equity market, then we've had a textbook rotation against the backdrop of improving fundamentals and rising bond yields. Namely, your winners were financials, oil, materials, and all early cyclical companies that naturally should benefit from that base case that we have outlined. Now, I think the question clearly is, you know, how far does it go? And Ben obviously has pointed to the risks already. We know that there is a lot of stimulus that, particularly in the US, is going to be applied. And we know that already that some of the base effects will mean that some CPI data points or inflationary data points might overshoot in the short term. And we have to be humble enough as well as that the market doesn't know yet how to interpret the average inflation targeting. And I wouldn't be surprised if that, you know, period will then be signified by more volatility. But clearly, as long as the economic fundamentals are coming through, this should be supportive for risk assets until we come to the point, and I agree with Ben, 2022 probably is the year where we will see the more sustained, you know, economic growth. And with that, do we still have the same resolve from policymakers, i.e. governments and central banks, to continue to apply stimulus? Because then inevitably we come to the point, you know, will we see a normal end to the cycle because central banks will have to step in? But we are quite a way away of this, of that. And until then, you know, as long as the earnings growth is coming through, equities should be well supported, but with very different leadership. So if we think back in 2020, how narrow we were dependent on a handful of names, this will broaden out. And so far, the rotation is pretty textbook on what investors should expect.
Right, so more volatility, but amid a broadly constructive backdrop. Eric, this is a great point to turn to you. What does the reflation theme that we've just been discussing mean for the outlook for emerging market assets, which have certainly not escaped the recent volatility? And to what extent is the uneven global rollout of vaccines a factor in your view?
Yeah, Max, I mean, the higher yields in the US is definitely a headwind for emerging markets. But I think the key question, I think, is to what extent are we in a kind of tantrum that we had in 2013 that Ben alluded to? And I think here the news is quite good. I think we are in a very different situation. In 2013, emerging markets were overheating. So demand was very strong, and we had very large current account deficits. You remember maybe the Fragile Fives. Those were countries with large current account deficits. We are now in an opposite situation. Most emerging markets are still well below potential, and we actually have an average current account surplus in emerging markets. So these external vulnerabilities are not there this time around. We can also see it, credit growth is lower, inflation is lower, so much cooler economies, which is good. We can also see it in positioning. So after the global financial crisis, massive capital inflows on the back of quantitative easing, but this time around, positions in emerging markets are much cleaner because there have been outflows due to COVID. So positioning is cleaner, valuations are more favorable. So in 2013, for example, the MBIC had a spread of 280, now we're at 380. So credit, for example, is not as expensive. So all in all, and then if you look at the global backdrop in 2013, the global manufacturing PMI was barely above 50. But now, as Sonia already mentioned, we are at the outset of a global boom, which should benefit emerging markets. So all in all, we are still quite constructive on this asset class. That doesn't mean that we like every emerging market. There are three, and I single out here, Turkey, Brazil, and South Africa, where we are worried just because the level of leverage is very high. To COVID, I would say even there, we are reasonably constructive. I mean, most emerging markets have now ordered enough vaccines to inoculate their adult populations. Natural immunity is much higher in emerging markets. So in Mexico, in Peru, we have probably natural immunity amounting to about 50% of the population if we believe antibody tests. Same in Russia, 40%. So that will help. And then we know that fatalities are much lower in emerging markets because populations are younger. So, and finally, emerging markets like advanced economies have learned to live with the virus. In a couple of them, we are now back to GDP levels that we had pre-virus, just because people have learned to live with the virus. So even on this front, we think probably herd immunity by the first quarter next year, later second quarter. So not too bleak, I would say.
Well, thanks for talking through those dynamics and moving from macroeconomics and markets to geopolitics. US-China trade tensions were clearly a big market driver under the Trump administration. What's your sense of the direction of travel under Biden?
Yeah, I don't think that we'll ever go back to the years before Trump. I think there has to be a fundamental reset in the relationships between the US and China. And I think to a large extent, China is to blame for that because China has clearly moved away from Western political thinking under the Xi leadership. It has become more muscular in its foreign policy. So I think we can understand why this is happening. And I don't think that that's going to change. I think what's going to change is the approach of the Biden administration. It's going to be more consistent, more coherent. I think it will be a much more multilateral approach. I think the administration will rely on Europe more when it comes to curtailing technological progress in China. They will rely more on Asian allies when it comes to containing China militarily. Liberal democracy and Western values will be held up as a rallying cry for democracies. The foreign secretary already has said that he agrees with the Uyghur issue as being a genocide. So. That's clear. And then I think there will be less of a focus on trade and trade balances, but more on technology. I think there is a sense that China should not win the race for artificial intelligence and quantum computing.
One quick follow-up question from the Chinese side of the equation, Eric, which is that China has just been holding its annual National People's Congress meetings, which end today. Did they reveal much about what we can expect from China over the near and medium term?
Yeah, so I mean, this Congress usually reveals some of the economic targets, and they did come up with a growth target of 6% for this year, but this is really not binding. So if China were not to grow at all from this point onwards, we would still see 6% growth just because of the base effects. So this is really not a binding target. They didn't give us any target for the next 5 years. And in general, I think this is a welcome development because in the past, these targets led them to overstimulate the economy. And not giving any growth targets really prevents this misallocation of capital that goes along with it. So that this is a very good development. The other important thing is I think we see mirrored on the Chinese side what we see in the US, basically this stressing of self-reliance, R&D, trying to make leaps in semiconductor technology in particular, where China is still very reliant on the US. China has said that they want to double GDP per capita by 2035. That would imply growth of about 4.5% per year. I think that's doable. That's what Taiwan and Korea managed at this level of development. And we would be in a very different world in 2035. I mean, China would be the biggest economy in the world, would be as rich as Portugal today, and would account for half of global output. So clearly a behemoth.
Right, a very different picture to today. Ben, you've been living in Hong Kong for a few months now. What are your early insights on the ground on the issues that Asia-based investors are most focused on?
Yeah, as you say, it's only been a few months, but I've already noticed a dramatic increase in the discussion around ESG, which is it's a global phenomenon, of course. However, what's interesting in the region is China, President Xi saying that they want to be net neutral by 2060. They did that only a few weeks ago. But you know, from a sort of command control economy standpoint, that filters rapidly down into, you know, the wealth funds, the pension funds, the corporates. And we're getting questions all the time now about how are we looking at climate from a carbon footprint point of view? How do we use our destination model in order to calculate temperature alignment for portfolios, the stuff that we've been doing for our investors, our clients? So that is, and I think that what goes on in China is that when they decide to do something, it happens quickly. So they might have been a little bit delayed compared to perhaps Europe looking at this situation, but there will be a rapid catch up. So that's going to be fascinating. And then the other thing, which is similar to something that Eric was saying about the stimulus situation in China. So I think China does recognize that they made a mistake back in 2009, 2010, when they overstimulated and created bubbles to some degree, that they had to make sure that the property market was stable because it was going far too fast. They all had a boom and a bust in the equity market, if you remember, a few years ago, similar, just too much money swirling around. This time, I've noticed that they really are trying to curtail that credit growth. They're tapping the brake. They might have to do it a little bit more because we got some very strong credit data just recently, which was a little bit too fast, I think. But we're seeing it, particularly in the property market. They're trying to just keep things under control, which is interesting because this could be the lesson learned potentially for the US. I mean, the US is stimulating now with almost no boundaries. It's just unbelievable amounts of money. They could be making the same mistakes as China made in 2009, 2010. So get ready, perhaps, for the US having to put some macroprudential controls on areas of their economy that get a little bit too hot.
That's very interesting. Sonia, we've covered a lot of ground today. What are the key takeaways for investors? And is there anything you'd like to add?
We did indeed cover quite a lot of ground. And to my mind, the importance for investors right now is really the understanding of clearly the strength of the expected cyclical recovery. but that this might not necessarily be equally reflected in markets, because if you think about the starting point and where spreads are, where valuation levels are, you might well find that the return delivery looks slightly different to what the strength is in the underlying economy. And this is what I would like to come back to, something that Ben has said, and in the way we look at this, and we have to find return replacements. Because if you think about your usual allocation, and obviously the 60-40 analogy has been used a number of times, but clearly if you think about the strength of the contribution from the bond part of that portfolio, we have to be realistic, will not be the same. And this is quite a significant change to understand what your credit and your bond portfolio can deliver in its risk return profile, because obviously the other side of that coin is risk mitigation. And so we are fully aware that despite the fact that the base case actually sounds pretty strong, definitely for 2021 and even beyond, if we think about this strong support that Janet Yellen, Joe Biden, and obviously Jerome Powell are putting forward as an example, we are fully aware that, if you look at, credit spreads, equity market valuations, a lot of that good story is already in the price. And so the experience in markets might be a bit different than it is in the real economy. But you think back, obviously, at the end of 2020, we said the experience in markets is actually quite different than in the real economy. And it seemed that market at that point were far more optimistic than what the underlying data said. So I think for us, the takeaway is that you have to be aware as an investor of those dynamics. And clearly, have to think forward and how you can achieve your financial targets, your objectives, and obviously clearly start thinking about the potential risks. As Ben has alluded to, you can't just simply because your 10-year treasury exposure, because liquidity-wise, you will hardly find something that is more attractive and will provide you with the same level of exposure and liquidity than those markets do. And this is why it's not surprising that a lot of clients are coming towards us with exactly these questions. And then you add to it the enormous amount of regulatory change. So this idea of accelerating topics, ESG right in the middle. And so you bring these two together. And I think this is what we are aiming to focus on, because clearly there's a lot that we can learn from long-term structural themes. But I think we have to be fully aware that the starting point and hence the risk return profile of markets is probably a lot trickier than what it was just last year or the year before. And with that in mind, I think that's what we will aim to talk about in our regular updates, and hope that we can shed some light into our thinking and help investors to navigate those markets.
Right. Yes, there's a huge amount to discuss in the coming months. Well, finally, before we finish up, I'd just like to ask each of you what you've been watching, reading, or listening to recently to pass the time in lockdown. Sonia, do you want to go first?
I've not just finished, but I can confess that I bought the book from Bill Gates on climate change and how to battle it. So it's quite fascinating, but I haven't quite finished yet.
Okay. And Ben?
Well, Sonia's my boss, so the correct answer is that I've had absolutely no spare time because I've just been working. Fortunately, that's not true. But here in Hong Kong, funnily enough, the restrictions are a lot less. I mean, the tube is still going fully, shops are all open, and most importantly, bars and restaurants are open. So I've been going to bars and restaurants. And also horse racing is allowed. You can go horse racing. So I've also been to Sha Tin. That was exciting.
Great. And Eric, what have you been consuming?
Yeah, not very highbrow. I've been watching or catching up on old series of Not Going Out, a British series, and it's quite fitting since I'm not going out.
Very appropriate. I'll look into that. I've been watching also a Netflix series called Giri Haji, which is quite a dark but fun show about the Yakuza. A lot of the action takes place in Soho. And with that, I think let's end this month's call. Thank you, Sonia, Ben and Eric, for your time today. Thank you to you, our clients and listeners, for joining us. And our next edition of the CIO call will be in April. In the meantime, you can find our latest updates via LGIM's social media channels, on the LGIM blog, and of course here on LGIM Talks.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating, or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous, on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and general investment management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, LGIM.com.